free state as being without human deficiencies. Actually, I think there are many similarities between groups of souls close to each other and human family systems. For instance, I see Norcross as the rebellious scapegoat for this group of souls, while he and Alam are the inventory takers for everyone's shortcomings. Alam said Norcross is usually the first to openly scrutinize any rationalizations or self-serving justifications of past life failures offered by the other members. He appears to have the least self-doubt and emotional investment over standards of conduct. This may define his own insecurity, because Norcross is probably fighting the hardest to keep up with the advancing group. I suspect Alam himself could be the group's mascot, often the youngest child in human families, with all his clowning around, preening, and making light of serious issues. Some souls in spiritual groups do seem to me to be more fragile and protected than other group members. Vilo's conduct demonstrates he is the current hero, or eldest family member, with his drive for excellence. I have the impression from Alam that Vilo is the least defiant of the group, partly because he has the best record of achievement in recent past lives. Just as in human family systems, the roles of spiritual group members can be switched around, but I was told Vilo's kinetic energy is turning pink, signaling his growth into level 2. I attach human labels on ethereal spirits because, after all, souls who come to Earth do show themselves through human characteristics. However, I don't see hatred, suspicion, and disrespect in soul groups. In a climate of compassion, there are no power struggles for control among these peer groups whose members are unable to manipulate each other or keep secrets. Souls distrust themselves, not each other. I do see fortitude, desire, and the will to keep trying in their new physical lives. In an effort to confirm some of my observations about the social dynamics among spiritual group members in this case, I ask Alam a few more questions. Dr. Newton, Alam, do you believe your criticism of each other is always constructive?
S. Sure, there is no real hostility. We have fun at each other's expense, I admit that, but it's just a form of acknowledgement of who we really are, and where we should be going.
Dr. Newton, is any member of your soul group ever made to feel shame or guilt about a past life?
S. Those are human weapons, and too narrow for what we feel.
Dr. Newton, well, let me approach your feelings as a soul in another way. Do you feel safer getting feedback from one of your group members more than another?
S. No, I don't. We all respect each other immensely.
The greatest criticism comes from within ourselves.
Dr. Newton, do you have any regrets for your conduct in any past life?
S. Long pause, yes, I feel sorry if I have hurt someone, and then have everyone here know all about my mistakes. But we learn.
Dr. Newton, and what do you do about this knowledge?
S. Talk among ourselves, and try to make amends the next time.
Dr. Newton, from what you told me earlier, I had the idea that you, Norcross, and Dewberry might be releasing some pent up feelings over your own shortcomings by dumping on each other.
S. Thoughtfully, we make cynical remarks, but it's not like being human anymore. Without our bodies, we take criticism a little differently. We see each other for who we are without resentment or jealousy.
Dr. Newton, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I just wondered if all this flamboyance exhibited by your group might indicate underlying feelings of unworthiness?
S. Oh, that's something else again.
Yes, we do get discouraged as souls, and feel unworthy about our abilities to meet the confidence placed in us to improve.
Dr. Newton, so, while you have self-doubts about yourselves, it's okay to make cynical remarks about each other's motivations?
S. Of course, but we want to be recognized by one another for being sincere in working on our individual programs. Sometimes self-pride gets in the way and we use each other to move past this. In the next passage of dialogue, I introduce another spiritual phenomenon relating to group healing. I have heard number of variations about this activity which are supported by the interpretations of case 21. Dr. Newton, now alum, as long as we are discussing how your group members relate to each other, I want you to describe the spiritual energy by which you all are assisted in this process. S. Hesitant, I'm not sure I can tell you, Dr. Newton, think carefully. Isn't there another means by which your group is brought into harmony with each other with intelligent energy? S. Long pause, you mean from the cones? Dr. Newton, the word cone is new to me, but I know I'm on the right track. Yes, the cones. Explain what you know about them relative to your group. S. Slowly, well, the cones do assist us. Dr. Newton, please continue, and tell me what the cone does. I think I have heard about this before, but I want your version. S. It's shaped to go around us, you know. Dr. Newton, shaped in what way? Try to be more explicit. S. It is cylindrical, very bright, it is above and all around us. The cone is small at the top and wide at the bottom, so it fits over all of us, like getting under a great white cap. We can float under the cone in order to use it? Dr. Newton, are you sure this isn't the shower of healing you experienced right after your return to the spirit world? S. Oh no, that was more individual purification, to repair earth damage. I thought you knew, Dr. Newton, I do. I want you to explain how the cone is different from the shower of healing. S. The top funnels energy down as a waterfall in a spreading circle around all of us and allows us to really concentrate on our mental sameness as a group. Dr. Newton, and what do you feel when you are under the cone? S. We can feel all our thoughts being expanded, then drawn up, and returned back, with more knowledge added. Dr. Newton, does this intelligent energy help your unity as a group in terms of more focused thinking? S. Yes, it does. Dr. Newton, deliberately confrontational, to be frank with you, alum, I wonder if this cone is brainwashing your original thoughts. After all, the arguments and disagreements between you and the others of your group are what make you individuals. S. Laughs, we aren't brainwashed. Don't you know anything about the afterlife? It gives us more collective insight to work together. Dr. Newton, is the cone always available? S. It is there when we need it. S. Those who watch over us. Dr. Newton, who operates the cone? Dr. Newton, your guide? S. Bursts out laughing, Chateau? I think he is too busy traveling around on his circuit. Dr. Newton, what do you mean? S. We think of him as a circus master, a stage manager, of our group. Dr. Newton, does Chateau take an active part in your group deliberations? S. Shakes head, not really, guides are above a lot of this stuff. We are left on our own quite a bit, and that's fine. Dr. Newton, do you think there is one specific reason for the absences of Chateau? S. Pause. Oh, he probably gets bored with our lack of progress. He loves to show off as the master of ceremonies though. Dr. Newton, in what way? S. Chuckling, oh, to suddenly appear in front of us during one of our heated debates, throwing off blue sparks, looking like a wizard who is an all-powerful moderator. Dr. Newton, a wizard? S. Still laughing, Chateau appears in long, sapphire, blue robes with a tall, pointed hat. With his flowing white beard he looks simply great, and we do admire him. Dr. Newton, I get the picture of a spiritual Merlin. S. An oriental Merlin, if you will. Very inscrutable sometimes. He loves making a grand entrance in full costume, especially when we are about to choose another life. He knows how much we appreciate his act. Dr. Newton, with all this stage management, I am curious if Chateau has much emotional connection to your group as a serious guide. S. Scoffing at me, listen, he knows we are a wild bunch, and he plays to that as a nonconformist himself, but he is also very wise. Dr. Newton, is Chateau indulgent with your group? He doesn't seem to limit your extravagance very much. S. Chateau gets results from us because he is not heavy-handed or preachy. That wouldn't sit well with our people. We respect him. Dr. Newton, do you see Chateau as a consultant who comes only once in a while to observe, or as an active supervisor? S. He will pop in unannounced to set up a problem for our discussions. Then he leaves, coming back later to listen to how we might solve certain things. Dr. Newton, give me an example of a major problem with your group. S. Pause. Chateau knows we identify too much as actors playing parts on Earth. He hits on superficiality. He is trying to get us to cast ourselves from the inside out, rather than the reverse. Dr. Newton, so Chateau's instruction is serious, but he knows you all like to have fun along the way? S. Yeah, that's why Chateau is with us, I think. He knows we waste opportunities. He assists us in interpreting the predicaments we get into in order to get the best out of us. Dr. Newton, from what you have told me, I have the impression that your spiritual group is run as a kind of workshop directed by your guide. S. Yes, he builds up our morale and keeps us going. Unlike educational classrooms or therapy groups on Earth, I have learned teacher, counselors in the spirit world are not confined as group activity leaders on a continuous basis. Although Chateau and his students are a colorful family of souls, there is much here that is typical of all cluster groups. A guide's leadership is more parental than dictatorial. In this case, Chateau is a directive counselor while not being possessive, nor does he pose a threat to the group. There is warm acceptance of these young souls by this empathic guide, who seems to cater to their masculine inclinations. I will close this case with a few final questions about the group as a spiritual unit. Dr. Newton, why is your group so male-oriented on Earth? S. Earth is an action planet which rewards physical exertion. We are inclined to male roles so we can grab hold and mold events, to dominate our surroundings, to be recognized. Dr. Newton, women are also influential in society. How can your group hope to progress without more experience in female roles? S. We know this, but we have such a fierce desire to be independent. In fact, we often expend too much energy for too little return, but the female aspects don't interest us as much right now. Dr. Newton, if you have no female counterparts in your immediate group, where do you go for those entities to complement your lives on Earth? S. Nearby there are some who relate better to female roles. I get along with Josie, she has been with me in some of my lives. Trinian is attached to Nyala, and there are others. Dr. Newton, Alam, I would like to end our conversation about your spiritual associations by asking you what you know about the origin of your group. S. Long pause, I can't tell you, we just came together at one time. Dr. Newton, well, someone had to bring those of you with the same attributes together. Do you think it was God? S. Puzzled, no. Below the source, the higher ones, Dr. Newton, Chateau, or other guides like him? S. No, higher, I think, the planners, I don't know anymore. Dr. Newton, a while back you told me some of your old friends were reducing their active participation in your group due to their development. Do you ever get new members? S. Never. Dr. Newton, is this because a new member might have trouble assimilating with the rest of you? S. Laughs, we aren't that bad. It's just we are too closely connected by thought for an outsider, and they would not have shared our past experiences. Dr. Newton, during your discussions about these past lives together, does your group believe it contributes to the betterment of human society? S. Pause. We want our presence in a community to challenge conventions, to question basic assumptions. I think we bring nerve into our physical lives, and laughter, too, Dr. Newton, and when your spiritual group has finished discussing what is necessary to further your aims, do you look forward to a new life? S. Zestfully, oh yeah. Every time I leave for a new role on Earth, I say goodbye with, see you all back here a day after death, This case is an example of like-minded souls with ego, inflating needs who support and validate each other's feelings and attitudes. Herein lies the key to understanding the formation of soul groups. I have learned that many spiritual clusters have sub-groups made up of entities whose identities are linked by similar issues blocking their advancement. Even so, these souls do have differences in strengths and weaknesses. Each group member contributes their best attributes toward advancing the goals of others in the family. I do not want to leave the impression from case 21 that the few remaining souls in this inner circle of close friends represent the behavior traits of everyone in the original cluster. When a primary group of, say 15 or 20 souls, is formed, there are marked similarities in talent and interests. But a support group is also designed to have differences in disposition, feelings, and reactions. Typically, my subjects report a male, female-oriented mixture of one or more of the following character types in their groups: 1. Courageous, resilient, a tenacious survivor. 2. Gentle, quiet, devoted, and rather innocent. 3. Fun, loving, humorous, a jokester and risk taker. 4. Serious, dependable, cautious. 5. Flamboyant, enthusiastic, frank. 6. Patient, steady, perceptive. 7. Thoughtful, calculating, determined. 8. Innovative, resourceful, adaptable. These differences give a group balance. However, if an entire group displays a strong tendency toward flamboyance or daring, the most cautious member would appear less so to another group of souls. There is no question that the souls in case 21 are in for a long development period. Yet they do contribute to the vitality of Earth. Subsequent questioning of this subject revealed the paths of these souls continue to cross in the 20th century. For instance, Alam is a graphic designer and part-time professional guitar player involved with Josie, who is a singer. The fact that the closely knit souls in this case were so male-oriented in their physical lives does not take away from their ability to associate with young souls with predominantly female preferences. Cluster groups are gender mixed. As I have mentioned, truly advanced souls have balanced gender preferences in their physical life choices. The desire for expression of self identity is an important motivating factor for souls choosing to come to Earth to learn practical lessons. Sometimes a reason for discomfort with the lower level soul is the discrepancy in perception of self in their free soul state, compared to how they act in human bodies. Souls can get confused with who they are in life. Case 21 did not seem to exhibit any conflict in this area, but I question the rate of growth achieved by them in recent past lives. However, the basic experience of living a life may compensate, to some extent, for the lack of insight gained from that life. Our shortcomings and moral conflicts are recognized as faults far more in the spirit world than on Earth. We have seen how the nuances of decision making are dissected and analyzed in spiritual groups. Cluster members have worked together for such a long time in Earth years that entities become accountable to each other and the group as a whole. This fosters a great sense of belonging in all spiritual groups, and can give the appearance of thought barriers between clusters, especially with souls in the lower levels. Nevertheless, while rejection and loneliness is part of every soul's life in human form, in the spirit world our individual ego identity is constantly enhanced by warm peer group socialization. The social structure of soul groups is not the same as groups of people on Earth. Although there is some evidence of paired friendships, I don't hear about cliques, stars of attraction, or isolated souls within clusters. I am told souls do spend time alone in the silence of personal reflection when attached to a group. Souls are intimate entities in their family relationships on Earth and engagement in group community life in the spirit world. And yet, souls do learn much from solitude. I understand from my white light subjects that souls at the beginning levels are frequently separated from their groups to individually work on simple energy projects. One rather young soul recalled being alone in an enclosure trying to put together a moving puzzle of dissembled geometric shapes of cylinders, spheres, cubes, and squares with self-produced energy. It was described as being multi-dimensional, colorful, and holographic in nature. He said, "We have to learn to intensify our energy to bring the diffused and jumbled into focus to give it some kind of basic shape." Another subject added, "These tests give the watchers information about our imagination, creativity, and ingenuity, and they offer us encouragement rather than being judgmental." Souls on all levels engage in another all-important activity when they are alone. They are expected to spend time mentally concentrating on helping those on Earth, or other physical worlds, whom they have known and cared about. From what I can gather, they go to a space some call the place of projection. Here they enter an interdimensional field of floating, silvery, blue energy, and project outward to a geographical area of their choosing. I am told this is a mental exercise in holding and releasing positive vibrational energy to create a territory. This means souls ride on their thought waves to specific people, buildings, or a given area of land in an attempt to comfort or effect change. 10. The intermediate soul. Once our souls advance past level 2 into the intermediate ranges of development, group cluster activity is considerably reduced. This does not mean we return to the kind of isolation we saw with the novice soul. Souls evolving into the middle development levels have less association with primary groups because they have acquired the maturity and experience for operating more independently. These souls are also reducing the number of their incarnations. Within levels 3 and 4 we are at last ready for more serious responsibilities. The relationship we have with our guides now changes from teacher, student to one of colleagues working together. Since our old guides have acquired new student groups, it is now our turn to develop teaching skills which will eventually qualify us for the responsibilities of being a guide to someone else. I have said the transitional stages of levels 2 and 4 are particularly difficult for me in pinpointing a soul's development. For instance, some level 4 souls begin targeting themselves toward primary cluster teacher training while still in level 3, while other subjects who are clearly level 4s find they are unsuited to be effective guides. Despite their high standards of morality and conduct, entities who have reached the intermediate levels of maturity are modest about their achievements. Naturally, each case is different, but I notice more composure with clients in this stage and above. I see trust rather than suspicion toward the motives of others on both a conscious and subconscious level. These people demonstrate a forward-looking attitude of faith and confidence for the future of humanity, which encourages those around them. My questions to the more mature soul are directed to esoteric ideas of purpose and creation. I admit to taking advantage of the higher knowledge possessed by these souls for the sort of spiritual information others lack. There have been clients who have told me they felt I pushed them rather hard in drawing out their spiritual memories, and I know they are right. The more advanced souls of this world possess remarkable comprehension of a universal life plan. I want to learn as much as possible from them. My next case falls into the upper portion of level 3 development, radiating a yellow energy devoid of any reddish tones. This client was a small, nondescript man nearly 50 years old. His demeanor was quietly courteous towards me when we met, and I thought him a trifle solemn. I felt his unassuming detachment was somewhat studied, almost as a cover for stronger emotions. The most striking feature about him was his dark, morose eyes, which grew more intense as he began to talk about himself in a direct and persuasive manner. He told me he worked for a charitable organization dispensing food to the homeless, and that he had once been a journalist. This client had traveled quite some distance to discuss with me his concern over a decline in enthusiasm for his work. He said he was tired and wanted to spend the rest of his life quietly alone. His first session involved a review of the highlights of many past lives so we could better evaluate a proper course for the remainder of his current life. I began by regressing the subject rapidly through a series of early lives, starting from his first life as a Cro-Magnon man in a Stone Age culture some 30,000 years ago. As we moved forward in time, I noted a consistency of lone, wolf behavior patterns as opposed to normal tribal integration. From about 3000 BC to 500 BC, my client lived a number of lives in the Middle East during the rise of the early city-states in Sumerian, Babylonian, and Egyptian cultures. Nevertheless, even in lives as a woman, this subject often avoided family ties, including having no children. As a man, he showed a preference for nomadism. By the time we reached a life in Europe during the Dark Ages, I was becoming accustomed to a rebellious soul resisting tyrannical societies. During his lives, my subject worked to uplift people from fear, while remaining non-aligned to opposing factions. Suffering hardships and many setbacks, he continued as a wanderer with an obsession for freedom of movement. Some lives were not too productive, but during the 12th century I found him in Central America in the body of an Aztec, organizing a band of Indians against the oppressions of a high priest. He was killed in this setting as a virtual outcast, while promoting non-violent relations between tribes who were traditional enemies. In the 14th century, this soul was a European chronicler, traveling the Silk Road to Cathay to gain understanding of the peoples of Asia. Always facile with languages, as he is today, my client died in Asia as an old man happily living in a peasant village. In Japan, at the beginning of the 17th century, he was a member of the clan of the Bleeding Crane. These men were respected, independent samurai mercenaries. At the end of this life, my subject was living in seclusion from the ruling Tokugawa shoguns, because he had advised their weaker opponents on battle strategy. Frequently the outsider, always an explorer searching for truth across many lands, this soul continued to seek a rational meaning to life while giving aid to those he met along the way. I was surprised when he popped up as the wife of an American farmer on the frontier in the 19th century. The farmer died soon after their marriage. I learned my subject had deliberately incarnated to be a widow with children, tied to a piece of property, as an exercise in the loss of mobility. When this part of his session ended, I knew I was working with a more advanced, older soul, even though he had a great many lives we did not review. Since this soul is approaching level 4, I would not have been surprised if his first appearance on Earth had gone back 70,000 years rather than half that amount of time. However, as I have mentioned, it is not an absolute prerequisite that souls have hundreds of physical lives in order to advance. I once had a client who entered into a level 3 state of awareness after only 4,000 years, an outstanding performance. I talked to my client about his current life and his customary methods of learning in previous lives. He explained he had never been married, and that social non-alignments worked best for him. I suggested a few alternatives for his consideration. Primarily, I felt his lack of intimacy with people in too many lives was obstructing his progress. When this session ended, he was anxious that we explore his mind further for perceptions about the spirit world in another session. Upon his arrival the next day, I placed him in a superconscious state and we went back to work. Case 22. Dr. Newton, by what name are you called in the spirit world? S. I am called Nentham. S. Pause. I am with two of my long-time companions. S. Raoul and Senji. Dr. Newton, and are the three of you part of a larger spiritual group of souls working together? S. We were, but now the three of us work, more by ourselves. Dr. Newton, what are the three of you doing at this moment? S. We are discussing the best ways to help each other during our incarnations. Dr. Newton, Nentham, do you have spirits around you right now or are you alone? Dr. Newton, what are their names? Dr. Newton, tell me what you do for each other. S. I help Sanji to forgive herself for mistakes and appreciate her own work.